Welcome to the debate. Today, we are stepping into the collective psyche of modern civilization. We're looking at a white paper titled The Invisible Architecture of Violence by Dr. Bachara Sahali. And the central question we are wrestling with today is, frankly, hauntingly simple. Why do advanced, democratic societies, places that explicitly value reason and human rights, repeatedly fall into cycles of conflict and escalation that, well, in hindsight, look entirely avoidable?
It is a fascinating piece of work, and it's a deeply provocative one. The paper essentially asks whether societal violence is primarily a result of external threats and strategic necessity, or if it's driven by an internal, subconscious architecture of trauma and myth.
Exactly. I'll be taking the position that unexamined structural forces, specifically what Dr. Sahali calls chosenness, myth, and trauma, are the invisible drivers of policy. They create this reflex governance that we fundamentally have to diagnose and interrupt.
And I will be coming at it from the other side. I am representing the perspective that while these psychological patterns obviously exist, they are evolutionary adaptations for survival. I'll be challenging the practicality of slowing down in a world of genuine threats and questioning whether dismantling our social narratives might actually undermine the cohesion we need to survive.
Let's dive right into the diagnosis then. Dr. Sahali writes from the perspective of a physician, and he makes this incredibly compelling analogy right in the preface. He says, just as a doctor looks beneath symptoms like a fever to find the underlying inflammation, we have to look beneath political events to find structural causes. When a society keeps repeating the same cycle of violence, you don't just treat the flare-up. You have to look for the chronic condition.
Right. And he identifies that chronic condition as the CMT syndrome.
Yes. Drawing on the work of Johann Galtung, which is detailed in Section 2.5 and Appendix A. The CMT triad stands for chosenness, myth, and trauma. Chosenness is this belief that a society is uniquely morally elevated, maybe divinely favored, or historically destined for greatness. Myth refers to the redemptive narratives we tell ourselves to simplify our own history. And trauma, of course, is the unprocessed historical wounds that a society carries.
Mm-hmm.
And the core argument here is that when these three fuse together, they create a collective subconscious. That's Section 2.1. This subconscious dictates how we perceive reality. So what we typically call foreign policy is often just the externalization of internal, unresolved trauma.
I want to stop you on chosenness for a second, because this is where I start to see a functional counterargument. The paper presents chosenness as a risk factor, right? Part of a pathology. But I have to ask, isn't that just another word for morale? I mean, every enduring society in history has believed it was special. If you don't believe your society offers something unique, whether that's liberty, civilization, progress, why would you sacrifice anything to defend it?
I completely see why you'd frame it that way, but let me offer a different perspective based on the text. The paper isn't saying we shouldn't have values. It's saying that when chosenness fuses with trauma, it creates a massive blind spot. When we feel uniquely virtuous, but also deeply wounded by our history, we stop perceiving reality clearly. We start interpreting every single external event through a rigid filter of us versus them. Section 5.2 literally calls this the externalization of internal conflict. Basically, we manage our own internal anxieties by projecting them onto an enemy.
See, that is exactly where I get skeptical. The projection argument. It suggests that foreign threats are largely phantoms that we create to make ourselves feel better or to resolve internal contradictions. But the paper itself admits in Section 6.3 that there is an evolutionary layer. These mechanisms, rapid alignment, binary thinking, they are ingrained in the human nervous system for a reason. They kept us alive. If a tribe spent 3 weeks debating whether the rustling in the bushes was a lion or just the wind, they got eaten.
But we aren't on the savannah anymore. We are in a world with nuclear weapons and dense global interdependence.
The hardware hasn't changed, though. My argument is that these myths act as social glue, and they are functional. Dr. Sahali talks about interruption in Section 5.6, stopping the cycle. But in a world characterized by technological acceleration and global power dynamics, hesitation is incredibly dangerous. If we pathologize our instinct to rally around the flag, we risk absolute paralysis against genuine adversaries.
I'm just not convinced by that line of reasoning, mostly because it assumes that reflex is synonymous with strength.
The paper actually argues the exact opposite. It suggests that reflex governance makes us weaker because it traps us in a predictable loop. Let's look at the concept of the ruling group mind, which the paper borrows from John McMurtry in section 3.1. It describes how institutions don't just execute policy, they filter reality. They literally decide what is thinkable.
The ruling group mind is a very ominous sounding term for what I would just call consensus.
But look at the mechanism described in section 3.3, taboo and the policing of dissent. The paper argues that certain questions become stigmatized not because they are factually wrong, but because they threaten the group identity. During a crisis, if you stand up and ask, "Wait, did our past actions contribute to this hostility?" you are almost immediately labeled as disloyal or irrational. That is not consensus. That is cognitive closure.
It is a compression of debate, sure. Section 4.3 actually calls it the rally effect. But again, I am looking at function here. During a crisis, you need that compression of debate. You cannot hold a graduate seminar when a national emergency is unfolding. The paper admits this isn't some sinister conspiracy. It's just a normalization of norms. If you have total narrative pluralism, which Section 7.5 suggests we should aim for, where every historical grievance and alternative view is given equal weight during an emergency, how do you actually govern?
You govern by not reacting solely with your amygdala. That is the crucial distinction the paper makes in Section 4.1. Under threat, the amygdala responds before the prefrontal cortex even gets a chance to boot up. The group mind creates fragmentation, which is discussed in Section 3.4. Facts get isolated from each other. So we talk about military action in one box, we talk about economic interests in another, and human consequences in a third. We never allow ourselves to see the whole picture. That fragmentation isn't efficient for governance. It's delusional. It actively prevents us from seeing the long-term consequences of our actions.
I just don't buy that the group mind is entirely negative. It filters out noise, which is a requirement for leadership. But let's move to the consequences, because this is where the paper gets very specific, and I know you wanted to discuss this. You mentioned projection earlier. Yes, let's look at the cycle of violence itself. The paper describes a mechanism called moral inversion in Appendix B. I find this both fascinating and deeply disturbing. It argues that we tend to view our own violence as benevolent protection. We see it as unfortunate but totally necessary. But when an adversary commits the exact same type of violence, we view it as proof of their intrinsic wickedness.
Well, that's fairly standard in-group, out-group psychology.
It is, but it leads directly to trauma multiplication, which is Section 5.4. Because we view our own violence as benevolent, we literally don't realize we are creating trauma in others. We think we are fixing the problem, but actually our reflexive, violent solutions are manufacturing the enemies of tomorrow. We are planting the seeds of the next war entirely because our myth of chosenness won't let us see the harm we are actively causing.
That is a very compelling argument. I'll grant you that. But have you considered that sometimes the enemy really is intrinsically wicked? The paper actually touches on this in Section 6.5, warning against simplistic diagnosis. Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, and sometimes an aggressive state is just an aggressive state. If we spend all our time psychoanalyzing our own moral inversion, we might literally talk ourselves out of defending ourselves against legitimate evil.
That is a totally fair point. And to be clear, Dr. Saheli explicitly says we shouldn't pathologize a society to the point of denying real threats. But he points out that chosenness blinds us to our own fallibility. If we could reframe chosenness as responsibility, which he explores in Section 7.2, we might act entirely differently. Instead of the narrative being, we are the most moral, so whatever we do is justified, it becomes, we have immense power, so we must be extraordinarily careful.
Responsibility is a nice word, but let's be realistic about the cost of stripping away a population's belief in its own virtue. The paper argues for moral maturity in Section 5.5, but if you systematically strip away the myth that we are the good guys, you don't necessarily get a mature, perfectly reflective citizenry. You might just get pervasive cynicism. You might get a population that says, well, everyone is bad, all states are violent, so why bother trying to be ethical at all? I'd argue that kind of apathy accelerates democratic erosion just as fast as any foreign conflict.
I think that's quite a pessimistic view of human capacity.
The paper fundamentally argues that a mature society is one capable of self-examination without collapse. And that brings us directly to the proposed solution, which is reflective governance.
Right. Section 8.6, redefining strength.
Exactly. The paper argues that in a nuclear age, we desperately have to redefine what strength means. Right now, our political culture defines strength as rapid, decisive reaction. But Dr. Selle suggests true strength should mean disciplined reflection. It involves trauma-informed governance from Section 8.4. That means structurally acknowledging past harms, both the ones we suffered and the ones we inflicted, so that they don't remain subconscious drivers of our policy.
Trauma-informed governance. I mean, it sounds excellent in an academic white paper, but let's look at the actual implementation. The paper talks about the vanishing of alternatives in Section 4.6. It notes that under intense pressure, diplomatic or nonviolent options just sort of disappear from the table. The paper frames this as a cognitive failure. I say it is simply a structural reality of the modern information age.
How so?
Just look at media amplification, Section 4.5. The entire global information ecosystem rewards speed and emotion. Emotional contagion travels magnitudes faster than factual analysis. The paper proposes media literacy in Section 8.2 as a solution. But is media literacy really a strong enough dam to hold back a flood of algorithmic emotional contagion? When the images of an attack are looping on every screen and the headlines are screaming, asking the population to pause and reflect feels like asking someone to sit down and meditate while their house is actively on fire.
It is immensely difficult, yes. I don't think the paper downplays that. But the alternative is recursive escalation, which is mapped out in Section 5.1. If we don't intentionally build the capacity to pause, we are simply doomed to repeat the cycle until we destroy ourselves. The paper argues we need to expand deliberative space under pressure. That is Section 7.3. That means designing institutions that are explicitly built to slow down the reaction time.
Institutions that deliberately slow things down? We generally call that bureaucracy. And usually, people absolutely hate it.
It's not about administrative red tape, though. It's about institutional safeguards for deliberation, Section 8.3. We are talking about things like the formal inclusion of dissenting analysis in intelligence briefings, protecting whistleblowers, ensuring that when the ruling group mind starts to aggressively lock in on a single narrative, there is a hard, structural mechanism that forces decision makers to look at alternatives. It's about creating institutional safety valves for groupthink.
I can certainly see the value in safeguards, but I always come back to the timing. The paper asks us to move from reflex to reflection, but reflection requires time. And in the geopolitical conflict, time is very often the one resource you simply do not have. If we build a system that constantly second-guesses every threat assessment in the name of integrating our trauma, we might find ourselves integrating our trauma while tanks are rolling across a border.
That is the classic realist objection for sure. But Dr. Saheli's counterargument is that the reflex often creates the very tanks rolling across the border that you are afraid of. By acting too fast, driven entirely by unexamined fear and myth, we destabilize regions, we radicalize populations, and we ultimately make ourselves much less safe. He argues that redefining strength to include restraint is literally the only way to survive in the long term.
And I suppose my natural counter is that you have to survive the short term to even get to the long term.
But let's look at the central insight in Section 5.7. It states that violence often emerges not from pure malice, but from unexamined patterns. If that is true, then looking closely at those patterns isn't some philosophical luxury. It is a strict survival requirement.
I will concede that the blindness to our own patterns is a major risk. Section 4.6 mentions how alternative actions seem unrealistic or naive in the heat of the moment, only to look completely obvious in hindsight. We have all seen that happen in recent history. We rush into a conflict, and 5 or 10 years later, everyone asks, why on earth didn't we try diplomacy first?
Exactly. That retrospective clarity is exactly what this paper is trying to drag into the present moment. It's trying to make the invisible architecture visible before the catastrophic damage is done.
It is a noble goal. I really just wonder if the human animal is actually capable of it. The paper brings up the evolutionary layer again in Section 6.3. We are, at our core, tribal primates
who happen to have nuclear weapons. The paper essentially says we need to upgrade our software, our culture and institutions to better manage our biological hardware. I'm just not sure the software patch is going to hold when the hardware starts critically overheating.
Well, Dr. Sahali clearly believes it can. He points to narrative pluralism in section 7.5. If we can tell a more complex story about ourselves, one that admits we are fallible, that admits we carry trauma and have caused trauma, we actually become less brittle as a society. A rigid, perfect myth shatters the second it hits historical reality, but a complex identity can adapt.
That is a beautiful way to put it, and it brings us right toward the conclusion of the paper's thesis. The invisible architecture is the root cause. If we don't address the CMT triad, chosenness, myth, trauma, and if we don't actively challenge the group mind, we are stuck. The only path forward is to make these subconscious drivers conscious. As the text puts it, what remains unconscious at the collective level becomes behavioral at the structural level. I absolutely acknowledge the diagnostic power of the theory. It explains a tremendous amount of what we see in the news every day. The media hysteria, the absolute moral certainty, the sudden collective amnesia about our own past actions. But I maintain a cautionary note. We cannot simply edit out our survival instincts. We cannot psychoanalyze away the fact that dangerous, bad faith actors exist in the world. The challenge, as I see it, is balancing this desire for narrative complexity with the stark ability to act decisively. We need to understand our trauma, yes, but we also need to keep our powder dry.
And I genuinely think Dr. Sahali would agree with that balance. The goal isn't absolute passivism at all costs. It is disciplined reflection rather than automatic unthinking reaction.
I can definitely sign on to disciplined reflection, as long as the discipline doesn't slowly morph into fatal hesitation.
The paper leaves us with a profound thought right in the preface, which I think sums up our discussion perfectly. A mature society is not one without flaws. It is one capable of self-examination without collapse.
That really is the trick, isn't it? Self-examination without collapse. It's a remarkably fine line to walk.
It is. The debate really comes down to this. Can we build institutions strong enough to actually pause? Can we structurally create a pause between the perceived threat and the violent reaction, where wisdom can finally enter the room?
Or will that very pause be the exact opening that our adversaries are waiting for? That is the ultimate gamble.
It's a gamble either way. The gamble of reflex has clearly cost us dearly in the past. The gamble of reflection seems to be the new frontier we have to navigate.
Well, it has certainly given us a lot to reflect on today.
Indeed. Thank you for joining us on the debate. We hope this conversation helps make the invisible structures of your own world a little more visible.
Until next time.